Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. In an address today to the National Press Club in Canberra, Greens leader Richard Di Natale framed Australia as a place in which many people are working too much in a broken economic system. In his speech, he outlined some alternative approaches to working life. To discuss these, he joins us now. Richard Di Natale, you're promoting the idea of a four-day working week. Are you saying the slack would be taken up by people who are now unemployed or underemployed, or that we could live with lower production and lower growth?
Well, I think there's a combination of things that could happen. And what we're saying is let's have a look at some of the models around the world. It's absolutely possible, as we've seen in places like Sweden, where in the aged care sector people are working a six-hour day rather than an eight-hour day, but they're actually delivering a productivity dividend. They're happier, they're healthier at work, they're actually producing just as much as they would be doing an eight-hour day. There are other options. It may be that we look at what Utah did in the US, which is a four-day week, compress the existing hours into those 4 days. It was something that workers in the public sector chose to do. There are a range of possibilities. But you're right, Michelle, there's a big problem here. We've got one in four Australians who say they work too many hours. And then we've got another huge cohort of people saying we're underemployed, unemployed, and we actually want access to some of this. So we've got a distribution problem as well.
I must say, with an ageing population and the message coming that we all need to work more and longer, what you're saying seems a bit counterintuitive.
It is counterintuitive in some ways, but sometimes in politics we don't ask ourselves the obvious questions. What is it that we're striving for as a society? What is it that we want for ourselves as individuals? What does work give us? Is there a point at which work, rather than providing us with meaning and satisfaction, becomes counterproductive? And when you consider that Australians are working longer than almost any other developed country, 44 hours if on average if you're in full-time work, you have to ask yourself, is that what we want for our lives? We know, and I saw this as a doctor, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, all of those things that unhealthy lifestyles contribute to, depression and anxiety, relationship breakdown. Most people, when you ask them, want to spend more time with their family, with their friends, relationships. They want more leisure time. They want to be more creative. So surely the first order question we need to ask ourselves, if that's what we want for ourselves and for our communities, then how do we organise ourselves in a way that allows us to achieve those things?
In the meantime, of course, many people would say they actually want more work, that they can't get enough hours. So do you need a policy, an interim policy, if you like, that helps people get more?
Sure, and I think no one's arguing for a moment that we don't do everything we can to try and create new opportunities for people, new jobs. We know in the services sector, health and education, we know the renewable energy sector is a very jobs-rich environment, sustainable agriculture, tourism, lots of areas where we can try and create those employment opportunities, reskilling people who are transitioning from one sector to another. We need to invest more in that. All those things have to happen. But when you've got a big group of people saying we're working too many hours and another group saying we don't have enough work, maybe there's an opportunity to do something about that gap and bridging that divide as well.
Critics would say that surely this is a policy for the better off because they can afford to sacrifice a bit of income, whereas people lower down the scale are often in a couple of jobs to try and just make up those dollars for the mortgage and other expenses.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the first thing to say is this isn't going to be appropriate for everybody. It's not going to be appropriate for all industries. But again, if we look at Sweden and you look at the aged care sector, now the aged care sector is a sector where people don't earn big wages. It's an area where that is underpaid. Isn't recognised as a significant contribution that, you know, we're not good as a society at valuing our caring professions. But in Sweden, they've managed to achieve a reduced working week for those people in the aged care sector. So it's not something that should be thought of as simply a choice that people who are well off can make. And it doesn't mean we have to sacrifice income. So if we change the way we work, construct our working week, That doesn't necessarily mean less income. It means actually doing things differently.
But someone would have to pay, and we already put a lot of money into aged care, for example, as a community.
But if we're just as productive through a shorter working week, and there's some evidence to suggest in Sweden that's exactly what happens, that you get to a tipping point where people are becoming less productive. There's also, as I said, the evidence of where you might compress the working week over 4 days. So you're still working the same amount of time, but you have a three-day weekend. There are different models. We're not being prescriptive about it, but it's important we start having this conversation, because ultimately when you ask people, what are the things in life that matter to you? It's those things that often are outside of work. Work gives us meaning, it gives us fulfillment, but there are other things that also do produce those things for us, and we have to get that work-life balance right.
By the way, how many hours a week do you work?
Far too many, and I suppose it's a case of, do as I say, not as I do. But look, I mean, politicians put their hand up, they know what they're getting themselves into, and if ever I think I'm working too hard, I think back to my father, who was an electrician, who worked long hours, physically exhausting labour, and I'm lucky I've got it pretty good.
Now, you've also canvassed the notion of a guaranteed adequate income. How would this work, and in what circumstances would you see it being appropriate and achievable?
Well, the first thing to recognise is that our social security system's failing us. It's not up to the job. We can commit people to living in poverty. We don't give people enough to support them. It's very inflexible. It punishes people for looking for work to top up their income. So we need to explore different models. I think the first thing we should all get some agreement on is, how do we improve the current system? How do we make it fit for purpose in the 21st century? But what's happening overseas is this notion of universal basic income is being looked at. It's a system that gives people a wage irrespective of income. It's not actually means tested. That some of those impacts are dealt with through the progressive nature of the tax system over there. And it makes sure that everybody's got enough to live on. There are a whole range of benefits to the economy. There are few overheads in administering it. So we're looking to see at the trials, we're watching them very closely in Canada, in Scotland, in France and so on. So that's, I think, something that we're keeping a very close eye on. We've got an open mind about it.
Now, you've again today had a go at Pauline Hanson, but just looking at the upper house count in the Western Australian election, I noticed that you and the One Nation Party are in fact polling roughly the same. Now, that count is not yet finished and we don't know where it'll absolutely end, but at the moment you're roughly at the same vote. Shouldn't the Greens be doing better?
Well, when you look at the environment in Western Australia and you look at the fact that when it comes to the sort of coverage Pauline Hanson got during that election campaign,
but much
I suspect a magnitude of, well, people said the same thing about Donald Trump, didn't they? And we know how that worked out. I mean, they got, I haven't done the analysis, but wouldn't be surprised if it was 100 times the coverage that the Greens got. We found it very difficult to be able to get picked up on a range of policy areas that I think were really strong. We didn't support the privatisation agenda when it came to the energy sector. We were very disappointed with the big polluting road project, Row 8. We actually took while Labor and Liberal were banging the drum, law and order when it comes to drug use, we were actually talking about treating this as a health issue rather than a law and order issue. Unfortunately, most people didn't get the opportunity to hear those things through the media. We did try to do that through a ground campaign, knocking on doors and reaching people. We look like we might pick up an extra MP, which is good news. So in the context of a difficult election campaign, we've held our vote and it looks like we might pick up an additional upper house MP. So I think that's a pretty good result overall.
Now, just looking for a moment at your party's internals, you seem to have perennial trouble with your New South Wales branch. Does the pressure from radicals in the party inhibit the appeal of the Greens to more centrist voters who might be discontented with the major parties?
Look, I think that there are people right around the country who are asking themselves some very big questions. They're worried about the state of turbocharged neoliberal crony capitalism. They're worried about the democratic deficit that we've got at the moment. We've got big corporate donations financing the put both sides of politics. We don't have an anti-corruption watchdog. And they're asking some serious questions about it. And I think that's a debate, not just in the Greens, but right across the progressive community. When you look at the rise of One Nation and Donald Trump in the States, I think people on the progressive side of politics are genuinely asking themselves, how do we respond to that sort of far-right populism? The answer always has to be by showing people we're the genuine alternative, that we have solutions. We don't just offer grievance and empty gestures. We've actually got solutions and a plan to transition the economy so that we ensure we've got renewable energy powering our nation.
But do your own radicals inhibit that message is what I'm asking?
Oh, I don't think so. And in fact, you know, within the Greens, I'm really proud that we're a party that has a range of voices, that is having a debate about what progressive politics looks like in this country. And ultimately, it's our membership that's our strength. We've got a lot of people knocking on doors, having honest conversations with people, and it is one of the reasons that we're able to, without the big corporate donations, still be competitive with both sides of politics.
One of the things you stand for in terms of government is more openness and accountability. How does this sit with not letting the media into your conferences?
Look, we do let the media into our conferences, and we don't let the media into the full 2 days of the conference. I think it's also important to acknowledge we invite the media
into
our...
The other parties do, though.
Yes, and what you see with the other parties is a stage-managed affair with all the real battles going on behind closed doors, with all of the debates stitched up before you actually get to conference. So I think you can do it one of two ways. One is to be open and honest about your conference and actually have those debates when you have an opportunity to meet people face-to-face. Or you can do what the old parties do, which is have those debates outside of the public glare of the media and then put on a stage-managed show and pretend that that's democracy.
Now, to go back to policy, you're calling for Australia to recalibrate its alliance with the United States or its relationship with the United States. Just what do you want done? Could you unpack that? And what would it mean in terms of our foreign policy, our defence policy?
Well, I think that the first step there is to acknowledge that the relationship, which has been in some respects a positive one, has also had a number of downsides. We need to acknowledge that we're the only country to have gone into every war since World War I, and that many of those have been foreign policy disasters. I think the principle of any relationship with the US has to be a recognition that we can't continue on that path, that there will be times when we say yes to say no to an ally, not give a blanket check. As we've done, as I said, with almost every other conflict, every conflict since World War I. So we can't just simply have a blank check and say to the US, we're going to be behind you regardless of what you do. And that's what the relationship does at the moment. So I think that's got to be the starting point. In terms of the impact it has on defence, that will be something that comes out of the discussion around what does a recalibrated US relationship look like. We don't want to be prescriptive about that. What we do know is that there are some purchases that we don't support. The Joint Strike Fighter, which has been, costs, I think it's close to $17 billion now, provides very little value for money, been criticised quite widely, both within the defence community and more broadly. And so rather than simply saying, well, this is something we can do together with the US because you happen to be our major ally, let's actually look at what's in the interests of Australians, what's in the interests of taxpayers. And it may mean, and I think in the case of the Joint Strike Fighters, it means starting again, cancelling that project, looking at what capabilities required and getting better value for money.
Do you think that the relationship could be recalibrated within the ANZUS alliance, or the alliance has to go?
Look, I think that's something that I think will come out of any discussion that we have with the US. This is a relationship. It's an important one. I don't think we're going to be prescriptive about whether we tear up the alliance altogether or not. We know that New Zealand has a relationship with the US that's very different to ours within the current framework. And I think that's a good model to look at.
Now, Parliament resumes next week and the Senate has before it the omnibus bill that includes an overhaul of childcare and a number of spending cuts. Firstly, do you agree with the childcare changes?
I think some of those childcare changes have much to offer. There is some, I think, positive moves when it comes to the childcare package. The problem we have with, that sits above all of that, is that the way this legislation was designed was that we were being forced to take money away from one group in society to remove funding that some people desperately need in order to fund the childcare package. And it was a form of blackmail, if you like, and that's the reason that we opposed the omnibus bill as it was presented to us.
Do you agree or would you accept any of the cuts in that bill?
Oh, we made it really clear that when it came to the omnibus bill, that those cuts were unacceptable to us.
The whole lot? You wouldn't compromise on anything?
I think when you're talking about taking money away from single parents, from families, look, there were a range of cuts in that legislation that would have had a profound impact on many average Australians. Why not look at negative gearing and capital gains tax reform if you're looking at revenue? Why not look at reforming the public health system so that we've got, rather than propping up the private health insurance industry, we can raise revenue, we can improve our public health system and have funding for things like childcare services that we know people want and deserve. Rather than taking money away from the most vulnerable Australians at a time when income inequality is growing, we think there are other areas to raise revenue.
In general, do you think this Senate is working better than the last Senate?
Oh, look, I think that's probably for others to judge. I know that the role the Greens have played has been an important one. We've stopped bad laws from getting through. We've helped to resolve some conflicts. The backpacker tax was a good example where we managed to negotiate our way through a fractious Senate where we got $100 million for Landcare funding. Look, ultimately, when you've got One Nation, you've got the Liberal Democrats, you've got people like Darren Hinch, and Jackie Lambie and others, it's always going to be a difficult Senate. What the Greens have shown is that we're the genuine alternative, we're a responsible force in the Senate, we're prepared to put partisanship aside to get outcomes that are in the national interest, but most importantly, we've been prepared to stand up against many of the policies of this coalition government, which have taken us backwards.
Now, Malcolm Turnbull today had his talks with the gas industry, and out of that came a commitment that the companies will provide more gas domestically, but the Prime Minister is emphasising that in the end the government could use export powers to enforce that if the result isn't satisfactory. Do you think the government should move to a system of reserving a certain proportion of gas for the local market?
What I think the government should do is recognise where the rest of the world's heading and where our future lies, and that's in supporting a combination of renewables, battery technology, storage, have a smarter grid, a network grid, demand management. That's what the future looks like. I mean, we're having a debate that belongs in the last century.
You don't see gas as a transition fuel?
We shouldn't be spending a cent on new gas infrastructure. We've got some legacy issues with existing gas plants and obviously existing coal-fired power plants. We've got to have a transition plan to make sure we can transition away from old polluting energy generation to new renewable, green generation. That's the plan that needs to be put in place.
You're not impressed with the South Australian new gas plant?
We just think, why would you spend money and invest in new gas infrastructure when that's money that could be spent on boosting renewables, increasing battery storage, having a smarter grid, demand management? Obviously, there are existing gas-fired power plants. We need to have a plan to transition away from those. But the idea that, I mean, we're still having a debate about fossil fuels, that if we continue to exploit them in the way that this government wants to do, we're going to lose the Great Barrier Reef. We're going to see entire coastal regions inundated, underwater. We're going to see more heat waves, more bushfires, as New South Wales just experienced this summer. That's the cost of exploiting more gas, of exploiting more coal, of opening up the Adani mine, and just not a cost that we should be contemplating, if not for ourselves, for future generations.
Can we just finish up by talking about your remarks about the media. You're essentially arguing that the media is getting worse. Can you just outline how you see this and whether you think anything can be done about it?
I think the media is absolutely critical in holding politicians to account. It plays a fundamental role in any democratic society. One of the sad things I've noticed is over the time since I've been in this job, the business model for the media has radically changed, and we're losing good journalists. We're losing the capacity to do thorough investigative journalism. We're losing the capacity to have specific reporters who have a deep understanding of issues. When I came here, we had a lot of terrific health reporters when I came to Parliament House. That was in 2011, when I first took up my seat. We've lost almost all of them now, and we just don't have the capacity. And that is a function of what the current environment, media environment, looks like. And that's a question, I think, for the media to resolve as much as anyone. What is a business model that can support good journalism? And I know many different outlets are working through that. I think what we see with the public debate is it's become more adversarial, more hostile, more personal, more partisan. I don't think that's good for debate. I have to say, I hope you don't mind me saying, Michelle, you're one of the few people who in this job I think plays a very even hand. You give an opportunity to have good policy discussions. You always focus on the issues. And we need more of that. We need to encourage more of that. Unfortunately, we don't have enough of it. How do you fix it? Look, I don't have the answers. I think there are a few things that we should do. We should be doing everything we can to encourage independent journalism. There are obviously new channels for people to be able to do that. We need to ensure we've got media diversity, and obviously that's a debate that the Parliament will have, I suspect, during this term. There's some of the things that we need to try and advance, but I think it's a bad thing for our democracy if we don't have a strong fourth estate.
Just on the question of the Parliament debating the future of the media, the government's obviously wanting to deregulate further. Do you think that legislation will get through the Senate?
Look, I don't know. One of the things, again, I've learnt is that politicians are very susceptible to lobbying, particularly from powerful vested interests, and the media is, particularly some outlets, have a lot of power, and they're prepared to wield it, to exert that influence. And I think in the face of that, some politicians do go to water. I just think the fundamental principle has to be whatever change is passed ensures that we've got more media diversity in Australia rather than less.
Richard Di Natale, thanks for speaking with us today. That's all for our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. Goodbye for now.